Want to build a tech startup? What do you do?
Entering the fifth industrial revolution.
What do you think outside of the tech has changed?
Every industry is going to radically evolve.
Should they still learn how to code?
We do need to be sort of fearful of what AI could do when it's...
David Zaretsky is a serial entrepreneur, founding multiple companies over his career, while serving as professor at Northwestern University, specializing in AI, computer science, and electrical engineering. He's taught hundreds of students, including myself, about the best ways to leverage AI while building a startup. It's my pleasure to sit down with him once again. So, Professor, you obviously began your career at Northwestern. You went there as an undergrad. You got your master's there, eventually your PhD. So how did you transition from the world of academia to the startup world, which the two are very different, in my opinion?
Started out doing research really early on as an undergrad, and that led into my master's research work. We spun out a company called Accelchip, which was later acquired, and then went back to do my PhD. And then a few years later, I had commercialized my PhD research. But it kind of spun out two companies from Northwestern, and mostly in the semiconductor tool space. Around 2004 or so, I was working for, there's a company called Xilinx. So going to their headquarters and looking down at this hall of just cubicle after cubicle after cubicle, and it looked like a rat maze. And I was just flabbergasted that, like, you know, it literally looked like little mice inside a rat maze. And I'm like, that is not what I want to be doing. At that point, I had made a decision. I'm not interested in working at, you know, these big companies. I'd rather be, you know, a big fish in a big pond and a little pond than a little fish in a big pond. And so that really kind of set me towards more of an entrepreneurial, you know, journey and co-founding several companies.
When you went back for your PhD, was your goal to do some research and eventually commercialize it? Or did you go back just for the love of, you know, learning? Or wanted to gain some expertise in something else?
I look at a PhD as not just a, you know, just doing research. It's a mental state of, you know, it's a discipline of how to approach problem solving. Look at a problem, research the problem, deconstruct it, you know, understand how to find others or common, you know, areas where you can apply different thought. It gives you a level of maturity, you know, be your own sort of entrepreneur and do the work on your own. And it's really up to you to come back and solve the problems on your own. It's that level of maturity, I think, that you have to develop.
You speak of maturity in entrepreneurship, but you teach a lot of undergrads that are going through the entrepreneurial path. You know, I was one of your students. What do you think is the most common mistake that young entrepreneurs that you teach are making today?
As much as I love teaching entrepreneurship, you really can't teach entrepreneurship. Instead, there you can read a book, or you can go to a classroom, and you learn like sort of the recipes. But the greatest lessons you could learn as an entrepreneur is failure. You have not learned how to be an entrepreneur until you really learn how to fail and fail fast. There's no, a direct line from point A to point B. It's lots of waves, lots of ups and downs, lots of hurdles, lots of sleepless nights, you know, and you have to be prepared for that. And no, you can't learn that in a classroom. And so you have to be, you know, cognizant of whether or not you want to go through that experience, right? I think what's most important in my classes is giving them the tools so that they're prepared. You always have a plan B and a plan C in your back pocket, you know, so that you can, when these things arise, you're prepared for them. And that you're still going to go through these ups and downs, but at least you can ride the waves and you can better prepare yourself for the inevitable.
Have there been any ideas that your students have had that you're like, this is a great idea, it can't fail, and then end of the day, it did fail?
Oh, there's lots of those. And there's lots on the other side. I'll give you an example. There was in this, my last class, there was a team who was working on an AI as a, you know, psychology. There are long, long lines to get into a therapist. Many people are struggling with anxiety and other problems, and certainly students, and you know, there's lots of things going on around the world. The thought was, well, we can create an AI that can respond to anxiety and you know, people with immediate needs and so on. And I just thought, you know, it's a great idea, but it's laughable because AI can't have that emotion. It doesn't make sense for an AI to take the place of a psychologist. Like, there is no, you can give it every book in the world and it still won't exhume that emotion, that sensitivity. Well, not 6 months later, NVIDIA and OpenAI are starting to come out with all new platforms in GPT-4.0, and you're listening to the emotion built in to this, the newer AIs and the LLMs. I sat back and I'm like, oh my God, like that was the missing piece. You can now create or synthesize emotion. And I go back and I think to myself, you know what, probably in another couple of years, this thing will be advanced enough. I didn't think it could get that advanced that quickly to create this, that level of sort of an emotional response when you're listening to it. I tell my students, you got to think outside the box, like really far outside the box. And some people go really, really outside the box. And I'm like, whoa, you got to take a step back there. Maybe it's a little too far, but you know, maybe I just wasn't thinking far enough.
Do you think AI, because you need such a new train of thought, such a raw train of thought, has kind of shifted the balance of power to young entrepreneurs almost having an advantage with little experience? Or do you still think having that entrepreneurial backing, maybe being a multi-time founder, still plays more to your advantage when leveraging a new technology?
In a sense of a new entrepreneur who is like really wide-eyed and eager and thinks that they can conquer the world versus somebody who's kind of done it several times and they might be seasoned at it, but, and they might know how to navigate the things, but that ability sometimes to kind of take big leaps, you know, might be more difficult for a more seasoned person versus somebody who just doesn't see all of the noise that we do. I would suggest that they have, you know, an edge early on. I do think though that you're, you know, as I mentioned, like you have to go through this journey of failure. You have to actually experience failure, build a thick skin, and to be able to continue doing this over and over again.
And building in this AI world, what do you think outside of the tech has changed since you started building, you know, since you started teaching and earning your PhD in fields like AI?
The level of productivity is increasing by orders of magnitude. I don't know, maybe I can code 1,000 lines of code in a day. I can do 10x that using, you know, ChatGPT and other tools, similar tools. And so I think there's a benefit there, right? Is that as an entrepreneur, I could now spit out an MVP and iterate and add new features much quicker. You know, the idea of agile development and sprints, like that's going to come much easier because the ability to quickly iterate and test and evaluate is going to become so much easier because the level of code and accuracy and all those things will be, you'll be able to do it much, much quicker. So there's a benefit for those who are really in tune with AI today and who are just really jumping in. That is absolutely game changing. And that's why, you know, we're really right now, we're in the entering the fifth industrial revolution where things are going to radically change. And I tell people this, and it's kind of scary, not just one little area of change. It's not just entrepreneurs and computer scientists. It is literally every industry is going to radically evolve to a point where, you know, it's almost like you're going to wake up one day in the next 6 months or a year, and you will not recognize. It's kind of like looking back at I remember the 90s, where I grew up in the 90s. And, you know, it's like flipping a switch. You're not going to recognize the days of, you know, oh, I had to code? What? What was coding like? You're not going to need to do that anymore. You're going to be, people are going to be elevated to a higher point, directors, architects, you know, we're going to be giving orders, prompting, and the AI will be building that under the hood. That'll be of programming in higher languages. We're going to be speaking in higher languages, and the AI is going to be the synthesizer who's going to turn that into action. I don't know if, you know, computer science as we think about it today the programmers and so on, those folks, I think over time, that type of design work, I think, is going to slowly get phased out and will be more, you know, sort of high level prompting will be kind of putting blocks together instead of actually going down and coding. The velocity in which change is happening, if you follow the AI and what's going on right now in the industry, it's happening so rapidly that you blink your eye and it's just like, boom.
Justin Fong, the founder of NVIDIA, has said that, you know, students, young people, they shouldn't learn how to code because in an AI world, you won't need to. But then Gary Tan, the CEO of Y Combinator, he still says there's an art to coding, almost like the digital camera didn't replace artists. So where do you see, and what advice would you give to someone that's a young entrepreneur? Where should they spend their time? Should they still learn how to code? Or is there something else that they should prioritize?
I use another analogy in my class. And once upon a time, you know, we as humans used to get around through horse and buggy and horses and biking. And then the car was invented. And the car really just allowed us to travel longer distances, connect with people, family, much quicker, much more efficient. The bicycle didn't disappear. We still ride the bicycle. Many people still ride the bicycles to work. But more and more people obviously today are taking, you know, cars and such to get around. That might change again in the future. But so just because new technology comes in to sort of augment or replace or improve, what it did was it just allowed us to be more productive. I can get from here to work in, you know, 20 minutes versus, you know, an hour. So I have more productivity. I can be working on other things. But I still enjoy biking and I love the exercise and I love, you know, the feeling of it. And I think the same way of coding, you will always need people who are developing the applications that other people need. So I don't think that's not going to go. You're not going to have for a while now, you're not going to have just AI building AI. There will be still the researchers and developers and stuff who are developing those next generation tools. So that's not going to go. One particular person will now be able to do the job of, you know, 10 or 20 people. And so you might need, in a particular company, you'll cut down your work staff. Where those other people go, well, they'll create new jobs. They'll create new companies. They'll do, you know, there'll be other opportunities. What matters most is not the actual coding, but the critical thinking skills that go around it. Right. And you were talking, referring to it as an art, you know, some of it is art. And that's absolutely true. I get the same sort of feeling, you know, when I code, when I write a successful piece of code as I do when I pick up a guitar, or play the piano. There is an element of creativity and such, that same kind of feeling. So I don't think that's going to go away. I do think, though, that as we elevate, the critical thinking skills is really what matters. And that's, by the way, just one other thing. I know I'm rambling here, but you have a lot of students who are just learning new languages. You know, they're picking up a language. Which language should I learn? And one thing I tell my students is, like, it really doesn't matter at this point, because a lot of that is going to disappear. What matters most is you understand the underlying semantics, the algorithms, the data structures. You understand what sort of technology to apply to what situation. That critical thinking skill is important to be able to direct the AI or whatever it is to be able to implement the right sort of solution for your problems.
If you're me, 23, know how to code the basics or don't know how to code at all and want to build a tech startup, what do you do?
Hire a CTO who's going to be your go-to to do all of those things. We're not there yet. But I would say that you never want to outsource your IP. Your technology needs to be done in-house. You don't outsource it to some dev shop or, you know, some people. So it's really important to first fundamentally, you got a tech startup, you need to bring in a technology person to help develop or oversee the development or actually go, you know, hit the ground and do the design work too. And that's often what I do too. I mean, I help startups and I come in there and I I will build or architect the technology from the ground up, you know, build the teams, launch the MVPs, and get it to the next stage.
So what do you think are the most overhyped and underhyped parts about AI?
You don't want to underestimate the potential capabilities, because I think that's probably the biggest mistake. I mean, we do need to be sort of fearful of what AI could do when it's put in the hands of the wrong people. But we also need to be sort of optimistic about the capabilities of problems we'll be able to solve, like solving cancer, solving new scientific problems, identifying, you know, threats and other things that I think could be really important. Where I think a lot of startups fall short these days is that they build their entire technology on top of, you know, an LLM, and they're just using an LLM to spit out something. And that in and of itself is not a value. I think investors have caught on to this, right? But anyone could copy that. It's going to come down to your data. You know, what data do you have that you bring that nobody else has, or the knowledge base that you bring? And so I think that has to be understood. If you just have an app that can talk to an LLM and it will give you it'll set up tasks for you and so on, like, well, anyone can replicate that, right? What can you do that's unique that others cannot do?
They're really talking about what people consider to be ChatGPT wrappers. And Sam Altman has come out and said, if you're making like a wrapper on top of OpenAI, ChatGPT-5 will, in his words, steamroll you. So what really is your definition of what makes a ChatGPT wrapper and kind of something that will last the times, that can't get steamrolled by OpenAI?
It's what you do with the LLM at the end of the day that I think makes a difference. As an example, there's something called agentic AI, for those who have not come across that yet. But, you know, when you code, it's an iterative process. So you'll write some code and then you'll test it, and maybe you'll get it right the first time, maybe you won't, and then it'll report a bug and you'll go back, you'll fix the bug and you'll try again. Maybe there's another bug, and or maybe the performance is not as good. Many things in life is all about trial and error. And the agentic flow essentially is this iterative process. LLMs today are basically single shot, right? You put in a prompt and it spits something out. There is no iteration there. Now, you can plug in tools and you can say, hey, go scrape the web and go find this information. But it suffers often from hallucinations. Sometimes it gets things wrong. So if you just accept it as ground truth on the first shot, I think that's where you're going to run into problems. Where you start to build newer capabilities is in this iterative flow. How quickly can you iterate, validate, optimize, and so on, right? And go through that loop and pull in different resources and stuff. Now you're sort of building in what's called LLM ops, you know, and tying different sort of threads together to kind of create something much more powerful. An LLM such as a GPT-5 is going to steamroll you. Well, that, yeah, I mean, it's going to have a much more powerful engine, but it's still going to suffer from the same problems that GPT-4 and GPT-3.5 and all these other ones do, which is there's the hallucinations, the you know, there's only a limited amount of knowledge it has, which is the stuff that it scraped off of the public web. It doesn't have private knowledge, and so you have to be able to bring those things to the table.
When you talk about like a ChatGPT wrapper, what is enough added layers, right, where you're building something that's not just, you know, like you were saying, someone can else just like replicate it? How do you know like you're doing enough?
You know, it has to pass the smell test. It's I don't know anyone can necessarily tell you, but it from internally, if you're the designer, the inventor, if you are simply just asking the LLM to spit something out one time, you know, that's not going to be efficient, right? Let's suppose you have an LLM. You have your Siri, your HomePod, or your Alexa, and you say, you know, what's the weather, right? And it reports the weather. That's not innovative. But if you said, you know, what's the weather, and it says, well, it's going to be super sunny out, let me turn down the shades in your apartment for you, right? It has not just automation built into it, but it has knowledge of its environment, its surroundings, to be able to take actions or suggest actions.
Mark Zuckerberg and Meta, they just came out with Llama 3.1, an open source model. And obviously, you know, OpenAI is a closed model. What is your take on the whole regulation of like open source models versus private having a few private companies run the most models, run like the larger model?
I think it's good to have a balance of both. We learned a big lesson from Google's epic failure with their release of Gemma. It was programmed with diversity that was returning some very incorrect historical knowledge or false knowledge. And so that was sort of catastrophic for them as their, first sort of model. And I think communities should decide what is the best sort of training, the best sort of model for their use cases. And so providing an open source model like a Llama 3 that you could then fine tune, that is, open source and so on, where you can do, do whatever you need to do or train it on what you need. That's great for individual, let the individual communities sort of regulate themselves. You do need private companies innovating and creating some of these things too. So, we're in a capitalistic society and I believe in capitalism, and you should have private companies creating private versions of their tool, and some people use them. And others will look to use some of the open source. I will say, as somebody who's kind of evaluated many of these, there is a limitation on some of these open source and what their capabilities are. If you're creating a chatbot with a serious, serious capabilities of being able to have, really, really dynamic conversations, you're not going to be able to do that with a Llama, 7B. You need state-of-the-art hardware and technology to be able to run like a Llama 3.1. That's very costly. And to be able to run that and to host that at its full capacity is not necessarily attainable right now for most companies. So I don't even, just because they released it, it doesn't mean it's really, quote unquote, available to the masses. Diversity and thought is really the most important thing. Putting it all in the hands of a couple of tech companies to own the technology and what the LM can and shouldn't say is already proven to be an epic disaster and bad for everybody. And so my thought is the open source, I think, creates a balance.
And what about the negatives, though? You consider deep fakes, but also AI can be used in more malicious ways than that. What are your thoughts on that, and kind of counter that being the counterbalance to allowing open source, allowing anyone to have access to an LLM model and program it to do anything they want?
The simple answer is you don't do anything. What you do is you come out with newer technologies to combat the security risks and identifying the deepfakes and so on. You don't shut down speech to protect speech. You create more speech to combat bad speech. And the same thing, I think, with technology. We're just talking about people creating images and creating videos. It sucks. But what we need is our tools to be able to recognize this is a synthesized image or watermarked by the AIs that this has been synthesized versus this is a, and there's technology that you can do that. So those could be built into the LLM, and which might be appropriate. So you're not shutting down speech, but at least or thought, but you are watermarking its originality.
I do have one last question for you. Since you started your career in entrepreneurship, has there been any routine that you've maintained throughout the years?
You got to have balance in life. I look at being a professor as half of that balance. Being an entrepreneur sometimes could be also a very lonely trek. And you work in small teams. Maybe you're solo. Maybe your teams are scattered all over. And being able to enter into a room and teach and mentor and converse and doing other things. That's one part of the balance of, this heavy work. So many things going on in this world, is easy to get lost, but you got to get out there. You got to connect with people. You got to find your place. You can't just shut yourself in a little room in a basement and just code the rest of your life. And I think that's what makes a true entrepreneur, is somebody who really ventures out into the world.
I think that makes for the perfect ending. And with that, I'm Sato Seth.
I'm Dave Izreski.
And this is Uninvested. Thank you.
This is a personal video. Any views or opinions represented in this video are personal and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations we may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity. The views expressed are for entertainment purposes only and not to be misinterpreted as actionable investment advice.